This is an interview with Elaine Leventhal. The date is June 10th, 1988. I'm Laura Smale doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project, and we're talking in her home. One of the principal issues that comes up in the university in regard to the medical school is the low caliber of research, or the lack of research that goes on there to balance the research that goes on in the life sciences. I imagine you know of other major issues, perhaps, such as patient care, but that doesn't seem to arise as a major problem. So I'm interviewing you because you're about to leave the university to go to Rutgers, and I know that you've been very much involved in research and had some difficulty getting your projects funded. All right. Wrong statement. Anyway, I'd like you to say briefly, describe the beginning of your career at the UW and say what you think is important to say about your experiences at medical school, but then concentrate on your period as a member of the faculty.
Okay. I should just clarify that we haven't had any problems getting our research funded. The problems have been in developing comprehensive programs to address the particular clinical area that I have my specialty training in. And so it's rather the difficulties in melding research of various kinds with clinical and teaching responsibilities that have been difficult here. Okay. And getting support for particular kinds of specialty areas, which in my case are not seen as particularly glamorous. So the care of the elderly is an enormous dilemma, but has never captured the imagination of most people in medicine because it doesn't lend itself to dramatic cures or really reversals, but rather deals with continuous burden of chronic illness and frailty. And for that reason, though it's very important for the public at large, and certainly we recognize the need within medicine, it's geriatric medicine has always had relatively little status.
Which would be true then anywhere, and
right.
Not isn't particularly
no, what's
specific
particular,
to the UW.
No, what's particular to the UW is that as the medical school has been unwilling to put any resources in to develop any program to deal with what is a significant clinical problem and one that is projected to grow over the next 30 to 40 years. And a particular patient population that will put enormous demands on the healthcare system and therefore really needs to be addressed both in terms of basic research, clinical research, and also education of health providers. But it's not a glamorous area. It doesn't give you new hearts and lungs or new limbs, etc. So, and it's not reversible. One can't change the aging process, but one can have an impact on the degree of independence that an aging individual can have and the freedom from certain of the enormous dilemmas that chronic illness places on them. And of course, that's why I find it a challenging area to deal with. But again, public sees the demand, the legislature sees the demand, but it's not been high priority in the medical school. There's been a lot of interest in aging research on the campus, but again, it's very scattered, and there's been very little ability to focus people in aging areas and bring them together in a way that would allow some really productive programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
let's backtrack
to
what you asked me first.
What you came to Madison when?
I came to Madison in August of 1967. Mm-hmm. My husband was offered a professorship in the Department of Psychology, and when I came here, nepotism ruled supreme, and there were very few women on the faculty, and essentially no husband and wife faculty appointments.
You had a PhD.
I had a PhD in developmental embryology and genetics. And
in what?
And genetics. It was
in developmental, you
know, embryology and genetics.
Oh, okay.
I mumble. I'm sorry. And in fact, people who had independent careers, if they married, then the wife invariably lost her tenure track position. I remember very clearly talking with Margaret Harlow, who had married Harry Harlow of Primate Lab fame. And she had, but prior to their marriage, had a tenure-track position in ed psychology. After their marriage, she became a lecturer. Mm-hmm. And just prior to her death, which is about the time when I met her, she was given a professorship. And as she put it, they know I'm going to die of a brain tumor, so now it's okay to give me a professorship. And she's very bitter. That made a very profound impression on me at the time, because I was told that it was very unlikely that I would ever be able to have an independent career on the campus, that I could be a research associate in a laboratory, and if I wanted to have a regular academic appointment, I would have to find another institution. And so the closest one was Whitewater, and I did teach at Whitewater, though I found the commuting very physically difficult.
How long did you teach there?
I taught for a year, and I tend to fall asleep behind the wheel. So the commuting was very hard on me.
And you had two?
I had two young children.
Yeah.
And I was teaching in the biological sciences, which meant late hours with afternoon laboratories. So I would come home in the evening, 5, 6 o'clock at night. And in the winter, I just found that very hard. Leave early and come home late. Mm. So I was, I suppose, after sort of awakening one evening coming home behind the wheel, I got a little bit terrified and decided I just couldn't do that. I don't like long-distance driving. So I came back and was a research associate in genetics. The first year was here in September through June of 67-68. I worked in the genetics department as a research associate.
Who did you work with?
I worked with Alan Fox, who is now dead, but at that time he ran Drosophila tissue culture lab and did a lot of experiments in cell genetics, and I had done some of that before I came, so it was interesting. I enjoyed it, but I still had a real need to be independent and be able to pursue some of my own interests. And so I came back for a year, and in the meantime, I had begun to apply to medical school, because it seemed that the only way that I might do something independent outside of the hierarchy of the university, of the academic departments of LNS, or would be to go into a different kind of area where I could even work outside of the university. So I thought, well, medicine might be the way to do it. And I suppose I'd always entertained a fantasy about going to medical school, but as a young woman just graduating from college at the age of 20, we had absolutely no money at all, and the thought of borrowing for an education just was not something that was part of how we thought it. So I just never considered going to medical school. I had gotten my doctorate training totally under scholarship, and so I'd never had to pay for my education. But I applied, and I was turned down 2 years in a row because I was told I was too old, and I was a woman. And at that time, the dean of admissions stated he had run surveys and studies on women in medicine and felt that they never completed medical school. Half of them dropped out, and even if they did complete their training, they didn't work full-time because they all had babies, and he didn't feel it was worthwhile investing in a woman. Well, I informed him that I certainly knew how not to have babies, because I had two children who were more than 10 years old, so in fact, they were 12 and 13 or something of that sort. I certainly understood how not to have children. I also understood how to finish things I started since I had finished my doctorate at Yale. But he kept calling me a crooked arrow. And I applied the second time, and he still said, you know,
who is this?
David Graham, who turns out since that time, after I did complete my training, we've gotten to be quite good friends. But at that time, he was just adamant. Well, he left the head of the admissions committee to become chairman of the Department of Medicine, and a different admissions chairman, Robert Coyle, did agree to take me in on a trial basis, told me I had to take gross anatomy in the middle of the summer in an air-conditioned laboratory, and if I could tolerate that, that maybe I had the guts to go on. So I took gross anatomy in the summer of 1970. And it was gross. I mean, it was incredible.
This is with cadavers.
Cadavers, right, in this 90-degree heat, you know, and it was rather amazing. And I shared a body with a fellow who had come to Madison from Virginia. Madison had one of the few anatomy courses in the summer. So people would come from around the country to sort of take it for a variety of reasons. He was doing a joint PhD-MD program. So Frank and I shared this body, and he then came here to do his residency after he finished medical training, and we became good friends.
Who was this?
His name is Frank Graziano, and he's on the faculty now. He's an immunologist. And we continue to be, you know, friendly. He's a very nice fellow. So we go back a long time, sharing Tilly. I certainly did perfectly all right in anatomy, and so I ended the full program starting in that September and finished medical school. And it was very interesting because there were, you know, David Graham had said that women entered medical school and didn't finish. And he said he had done surveys. Well, that probably was true when you took in one or two or three women and one didn't finish. That's 33% of the group that doesn't finish. Or you take in four and two don't finish. That's 50%. Class before mine had four women. My class had the grand total of 14, of which two dropped out, both minority women. And we all finished, all 14, all 12 of us. And it was a rather extraordinary experience. There was a lot of difficulty, certainly in the clinical setting, with having so many women around. It hadn't happened before that there were, you know, three times more than there had been here before. And we really were pioneers in those days. We fought and fussed about where we were taught, and we were excluded from the surgical teaching because it used to take place in the men's locker room, and we raised holy hell about that. And so it was an interesting experience.
Were you effective?
Oh, yeah. We said, close the door to the locker room, and there's a lounge here, and we'll sit in the lounge. You keep the other door closed. We're not interested in how many, you know, watching you get undressed. We want to be part of the teaching. So they closed the door, but it created a bit of a fuss. It was very interesting to be on the wards in which the nurses had to deal with women trainees, which was unusual for them. That was a very interesting experience. But, you know, most of us finished.
Was it psychologically difficult? But I mean, did sexist jokes and that's...
That was... I didn't realize what a sheltered life I had led. Here I was in my late 30s, and God, I was sheltered. It was an extraordinary education.
What do you mean?
Medicine. Well, sheltered in terms of sexist jokes and this kind of humor, which is very much a part of medicine. I suppose it's nothing is sacred anymore. You get to... everything is totally exposed. And so... the way in which you start thinking about human beings changes. You really look at, you have to lose much of your inhibitions about certain things or you can't function. And you have to disassociate yourself emotionally from what you do and really make decisions based upon the needs of the person you're dealing with without making value judgments or thinking about yourself. You really must do that in order to be effective. It's a very unusual kind of experience. And so I found it really, maturing in a very enormously compressed kind of maturation. For someone I thought was fairly mature, and I realized how much more growth I could experience, and it was really kind of an amazing situation to be in. So there was that. There was a lot of sexism. Also, in the clinical setting, within the hospital, there are amazing kinds of pecking orders and hierarchies, and having women come into what will be an authoritative position. Whereas women traditionally in medicine had been the nurses who took orders, very few women giving them. It was very interesting. And we were really the largest number to appear on the scene. So it had a real impact on just delivery of care. And it's continued to change. And I've watched that evolve. And that's been really fascinating. Being older, too, gave me the advantage of being able to step back and look at all these kind of interrelationships and dialogues going on between my colleagues and everybody around them. Because being a little older, certain things were not done to me. I mean, I was not pimped in terms of questioning. And they really treated me a little bit differently as far as that went. Because I think it was expected I wouldn't tolerate being abused, which was good because I think it also tempered them then to everyone around me.
So you got more respect than
a little bit more, right? I do think so. I think so. They tread a little bit more carefully in terms of some of the interpersonal things, though always placing the same demands on me in terms of what I was expected to know and what I was expected to do, but some of the interpersonal things were a little bit nicer.
What would you say about the quality of the faculty that taught you?
It's very mixed. Just you started saying something about the difference in research on the medical school. There's no question that the academic campus is an illustrious campus with many superb research laboratories and people in the humanities who have made significant contributions. A very strong university. The medical school has never been as strong as the rest of the campus. The medical school has pockets of excellence. There are people who indeed do very fine research. But as a whole, the caliber of the research at the medical school does not match the caliber on the campus. I mean, there are certain departments which are really extraordinary in the campus, and it just doesn't come quite there, though I can name the people at the medical school who do very fine work. Much of the stuff is very derivative, and I'm just not tremendously impressed by people who, quote, do laboratory research, and what they're doing is testing fourth-generation drugs.
But what I was asking you about the teaching. Does this
I was just getting to that.
Okay.
So you have very spotty caliber of researchers, and just as you also have people who are excellent teachers and a lot who are very mediocre teachers. And in the clinical setting, I was very much disappointed in much of the clinical teaching. There are some people who are superb teachers and they stand out. But then I had a lot from whom I learned by negative example. I did not want to do such and such. Mm. And that is not how I would do things. And that's a little disappointing. I would have liked to have better training in certain areas. And I appreciated how much more I would have liked as I continued, to grow and have more experience.
Did you have any reason to think this this medical school had
more of that?
Worse teaching than other places?
Well, some. I think it's worse than many and better than some. I mean, it's again, yeah. it's sort of sitting in the middle. It's has a little smidgen of mediocrity. It should be better because the university is better. Mm. It's just not up to the standards of the rest of the university. It should be better. And there are some superb people that I have had the opportunity to interact with.
Cool.
And or someone like William S. Middleton, fantastic teacher.
Did you have him as a teacher?
I had him as a third-year medical student. Okay, I had the opportunity of interacting. He was fantastic, but he was already retired at the VA. So my contact with him was very, very limited. But I appreciated how fantastic it could be to have teachers like that.
Hmm.
He was wonderful. I think I maybe interacted with him 5 or 6 times. That's very little.
When
but each time... Yeah, but each time, God, I just learned. I mean, it was just like I felt like a sponge. He was just incredible.
I'm glad you said that, because most of the interviews about touching on him have to do with him as a dean and do speak of him as a superb clinician, but nobody has experienced it.
Well, I had, because he had already, when he became the medical director at the VA after he retired. And here was this elderly man in his late 70s, early 80s, who still was incredibly up-to-date and with an extraordinary experience, but intellectually very up-to-date and very alert, and who could also teach. He could verbalize what he was doing. He could explain the subtleties of what he was doing. And his clinical skills were just beautiful. They were absolutely incredible. He convinced me that a light touch teaches you more than probing, you know, cramming fingers, and for various reasons. And he was just, you know, he would show you little pearls of things to do, which was amazing. And yet he had essentially retired from active involvement in teaching and mainly worked with students on weekends when we were at the VA, and that's where I saw him. Mm-hmm. So he would have a teaching session every week when you were rotating in those services, and would take us around to examine patients and then take us back into a didactic setting, and he would set up microscopes and then correlate what we saw in the wards with what we saw under the microscope. It was just beautiful, absolutely beautiful. So I regret not having had more of him or more of people like him.
Yeah. Are there others that you would
There
make?
Are some others, yes. Not a great many, though, in medicine, unfortunately, which is one of the reasons I think we're seeing fewer and fewer students going into internal medicine when they graduate from this medical school. They don't have enough role models that excite them, and that's terrible. They don't see role models that are excited about the intellectual challenges of internal medicine. So we're at a kind of crossroads here at this school, certainly in terms of where our students go and what they elect to do residencies in. There are a couple of surgeons that are very fine teachers.
Mm-hmm.
People... in pediatrics are also excellent mentors, and so you see a lot of kids going in that direction. Part of the reason I think we see some of the mediocrity is that there's a lot of ingrown hiring. There's less willingness to go outside and look at what's available and bring people in. It's almost as if the mediocrity perpetuates the mediocrity. And that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. At a major institution, one should really scan the country for faculty. There's relatively less of that here than there should be.
That's always been one of the problems.
Right. And here. I think that's really what sits at the bottom of the problem. You're just not willing. Well, it's protective, you know. It's if you expose by bringing too much in from the outside, you expose the level of what's acceptable here. Mm-hmm. Also, some of the standards for promotion are not quite what they should be. Also, people are not rewarded for some of the things which are very important in medicine, for some of the kinds of clinical research, which could have an impact on excellence here. They're just not, they're rewarded for anything that smacks of wet bench, even if it's completely derivative. And so,
say, of
wet of the laboratory, anything that's in test tubes or models seems to carry more weight than other kinds of clinical research. And yet, medicine is not a basic science. Medicine is an applied profession. And there are enormous numbers of questions which need to be addressed in the clinical setting and which are not addressed as well as they could be. Because you don't get rewarded for certain things. You get rewarded for others.
So you, what had, did you, you specialize in internal medicine?
Internal medicine, yeah. I had first, did you want me to backtrack a little bit?
If.
When I finished medical school, since I had had my doctorate in embryology and genetics, I was encouraged to think of some professional training that would use that kind of background. And I was really pushed by people in the medical school to go into OB, because I thought that was the perfect place for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't really like it. I didn't like it as a medical student, but I thought, well, you know, maybe if you specialize in it, you can go off in a particular area. And, well, I liked it less and less the more I did it.
Why?
Well, I don't like surgery particularly. And I found my colleagues in OBGYN, most of them, frustrated major general surgeons. The thinking was, I find, very narrow. I find much more to the female than just the genitalia. I'm much more interested in the total body. I found their approach to dealing with patients very alien to my way of thinking. I wasn't terribly excited about childbirth as end all. That's fine and good and very important, but I was much more interested in pathology and clinical issues. I didn't get rewards about delivering normal babies. Mm. And I hated the hours. I absolutely detested them. Mm. I found oncology, cancer of the GU tract, much more interesting. So if I was going to go in that direction, it didn't make sense for me to stay in OBGYN, since I really hated gynecological surgery. Cancer surgery is terrible. And I mean, it's just, it has no subtlety or finesse about it. It's a very gross kind of surgery to be involved with. The diseases are really terrible. So I thought that I would be much better off being in an area which really dealt more with the whole person. So that's why I went into medicine, which I knew I liked from the beginning, and I really knew I liked because I spent most of my first year in OBGYN as a medicine resident. It's part of the normal way in which you train. You spend time on medicine. And I was so unhappy when I had to leave that and go back to OBGYN. So it was really the right choice for me. And once I changed, I knew it was the right choice because I just found it very intellectually stimulating, even though...
Okay.
Even though I can't remember what I said. Even though you know, it's enormous amount of pressure to be on medicine. It's a very physically demanding kind of program, but I found it very interesting, and I found that indeed I was making use of my training in terms of embryology and genetics, in that I found myself approaching medical problems in terms of process time-related change, developmental change across the lifespan. So what I was really doing was kind of extending my way of thinking beyond early development throughout the entire lifespan. I found change over middle years, which we weren't taught about at all in medical school. We sort of stop with our training at maturation, adulthood, and as if adulthood means nothing else happens. And there was essentially no real dealing with the problems of aging and normal aging, let alone pathologies unique to aging. We really taught in disease entities without thinking of them in terms of into the entire individual. And also, we really weren't taught about what happens when someone has more than a single disease or has two or three diseases, how those then become interrelated and almost synergistic in their effects on the organism, accelerating particular aging problems and accelerating one disease by having the second one around. So it was just kind of an evolution in my approach to medicine. So that when I finished my residency and my friend Cal Cunin got a grant from the VA to start a geriatrics program here, it wasn't too hard to have him convince me that this might indeed be something that I would find fascinating.
What year is this?
This was 77. 77. No, 79. Excuse me. 79. So Cal Cunin was an amazing man, again, a very excellent teacher, who came here with great ambitions, wanting to be chairman of medicine. And he was rather, even though he was very bright, he was a very abrasive man, alienated most of his colleagues, and he was never accepted as chairman of the department. Became chief of medicine after Middleton retired at the VA, and therefore was in a position to develop programs at the VA, and was incredibly foresighted in seeing that the VA was willing to start building programs to look at geriatric training because they were very concerned about increasing numbers of older veterans, and that they indeed were much ahead of their time compared to traditional medical schools. And so he took advantage of their starting new programs and put in some applications for a couple of different projects, one of them being fellowship training, and he got it, even though there was nothing here and there was nobody here to train. He figured if he chose wisely, we'd train ourselves. And so and he would be available as a mentor, kind of sort of nurturing us along, but we would train ourselves. So he really twisted my arm. But as I said, didn't have to twist too hard because I thought it potentially could be very interesting.
Excuse me, what had you thought of yourself as doing before this opportunity came up?
I was going to go into oncology.
But were you going to be a practicing physician or a researcher?
No, I really hoped. I suppose I don't think I sat down and calculatedly said, coldly, I was going to do this or that. But I suppose I always had this kind of expectation that I would eventually find a place where I could combine a couple of different things, that I could continue to do some kind of research and combine that with patient care. I love taking care of patients, but it was clear from the beginning that there are so many things we didn't understand very well, and I wanted very much to continue to keep my fingers in some kind of research.
Did you hope to stay here,
I did. I must have expected that, because I tried very hard to do it. Mm-hmm. Even though I explored many different positions around the country when it looked like there was no way I could stay here, because this medical school wasn't the least bit interested in geriatrics. This was the program was at the VA. It wasn't in the wasn't at the U. They really weren't interested in having any faculty. They said, fine and good, you get your training at VA, go work in a VA. And, that didn't appeal to me at all.
I meant when you were in medical school, that's how you
I suppose I must have had that. Well, I was younger then. I thought, could get something here. If not, well, we'd look someplace else. Maybe, you know, there's always a possibility. I don't think I really was honestly thinking about it.
But the fellowship under this grant, yes. How do you spell his name?
Kunin, K-U-N-I-N.
Kunin. That was what set you on the path of geriatric
right,
medicine.
Right. That was a formal
which you hadn't
training.
Planned to do before.
No, I was thinking of going into oncology, which would have led me into clinical practice and lab and, you know, that kind of thing. Because I found here again the whole problem of uncontrolled growth, in a sense, mirrors what I had spent so much time thinking about in terms of controlled normal growth, in terms of embryological development and genetic control of development. And it's still that same kind of thinking. You're just putting in a slightly different context, but the thinking is still the same. How you address problems are still the same. What controls things, what turns them on and off. It's the same, you know, intellectual exercise. And
were you more academically oriented than most of your fellow?
Oh yeah,
residents?
But I had it. But I look at all the years I spent at Yale. And
so you, you were.
Oh yeah, always.
This wasn't something you could talk to them much about.
No, they. I spent relatively no time, little time, talking about such things with my my fellow students. Hmm. In fact, many of them, which is another problem, which we didn't address before. Many of them kept saying, what do we have to have all this basic stuff for? Just show us how to do things. One of the problems with the medical school is some of the students they take in. I mean, they are committed by the state to turn out practitioners. And they get a lot of bright people who become interested in academic research and are interested in truly acting as if they are doctoral candidates, when really medicine, by and large, is just training technicians, service providers. So many of my classmates had no particular desire to talk about these things with me. They thought I was a little peculiar anyway, this old lady coming in. But I did have some who were much more in tune with the things that I found interesting and exciting. They went into the same kind of direction I did. So one of the things that happens, you have a relatively large number of students who are not that excited about the intellectual pursuits. They go through residency, and then you keep a couple of them on your faculty, sort of, on your clinical faculty. It's this cycling that happens. Or even if you keep some of the brighter ones, it's still too ingrown. Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to geriatrics.
And how did you meet Kunin then?
Well, Kunin was a faculty member here. You know, we got to know him. As a mature lady, we just talked more when I was on the wards. We met him a couple of times through friends socially. So it was what happens on an academic campus, you know. And so we spent a lot of time talking, and he was very broad in his interests. And as I said, he was quite an abrasive man. So socially, he wasn't always as welcome in the medical social life as he was on the rest of the campus. So we tolerated his abrasiveness. It wasn't directed at us. So we got along very well.
All right, now start off with your...
So Cal was excellent mentor, very supportive. He was ready to nurture something that he really saw having impact in terms of quality of care for a population that was really quite different than any we had to deal with before. A population that had a lot of needs, both in terms of clinical needs, but also needed to be studied from a basic science point of view, because we knew relatively very little about aging and very, very long, old, people that have aged for many, many more years. So there were a lot of issues that could be addressed, And there were there was going to be a demand for service providers as the population grew. We have to deal with them. Then certainly there was going to be a public call for specialty trained people. And for academics to impact on medical training so that you didn't have to have specialists, but that the internists and generalists could indeed address the needs of the older patient. They would start thinking more in terms of process and lifespan and things of the sort. So a challenging kind of new area. It's an area which parallels pediatrics. When pediatrics got started in the early part of the century, you had suddenly a need to address the unique problems of children. And so you put together all of these things. Anyway, unfortunately, Cao had all the right motives and all the right resources in place, except having no real faculty to train the fellows. When he decided that he couldn't really move or rise in the hierarchy here at this institution, when he decided to go to OSU, Ohio State, and become chairman of the Department of Medicine there, which he did right after we came, it left us in the lurch completely. That we just had no mentoring. So there's one other person and myself started, we were the first fellows, and so we trained each other. And we got along extremely well. Two women who were kind of fascinated by the challenges of this new area. And so we dialogued constantly. And then we had the opportunity to go to Europe. The VA at that time was sending fellows to a variety of geriatric centers, either in the UK, and they offered positions in Sweden, though I don't think anybody went. And so I went to England, and much of what I had the opportunity to learn there really formed the basis on which I then built what I needed to deal with geriatric medicine here. It was probably the most important part of my experience during that fellowship here. And that kind of exposure made me appreciate where we had to grow in this country, what kinds of issues needed to be addressed and adapted here, and it really solidified my commitment to looking at normal aging and to looking at the maintenance of functional independence, to looking at ways of trying to prevent frailty and all those changes in that are involved with the loss of personal autonomy that put people at risk for institutionalization, for infantilization, which occurs when someone becomes so dependent on another person, which is what I find the real challenge in geriatrics. Some of my colleagues are very concerned with the actual frailties themselves and spend much of their research time looking at incontinence and immobility and dementia. I think from my point of view, I would have much more impact on those I teach and those I look at if I look at aging at a different time in the lifespan, at a time when perhaps one can think about those interventions that will maintain as much function as possible, that will have some way of preserving some quality in a person's life, because I see very little quality when someone is so functionally dependent. So my experience in England had a great deal to do with that. And after I completed this program...
What exactly did you do in the program?
Well, we took part... We set up a whole variety of clinical settings We set up a geriatric clinic in which we put in place those kinds of tools that were seen as the accepted way to start thinking about age-related changes in the elderly. We set up a whole variety of unique service programs.
This is all in the VA hospital.
Yeah. The VA is a kind of not the real world. You can put together things in a way you really can't do on the outside.
But you have freedom to do this.
Yeah. We did an enormous amount of reading. We offered a consult service in which we started to look at people with risk in the hospital and to look at different ways of assessing them. And we had an opportunity to put in place intervention programs that were designed to maintain as much independence and function rehabilitation as possible. We developed some simple research protocols, collected a little bit of data, put in place an interdisciplinary team, because much of the assessment that has to be done for an elderly person is best done by non-medical people, because many of the problems are not medical problems, but indeed are psychosocial and have very much to do with social networking. So we put together a team that also included service providers that could address specific needs, such as rehabilitation therapists, nutritionists, because occult malnutrition is a significant problem. We educated ourselves by doing essentially kind of didactic training among ourselves. We took some subspecialty rotations, so we got some more experience in neurology and rehabilitation and things of that sort. And then we finished. I mean, we compressed all this. We also spent, as I said, time abroad. So we did a lot of educating of others as we educated ourselves. I was called on almost immediately by people in the community to start talking about aging.
This is as you began the
fellowship. As we were identified as someone with interests in geriatrics, everybody began asking us to be experts. Mm. And so what I found is that you very rapidly become educated in areas that you're asked to address.
I just have a couple of questions about the VA hospital experience. What was the name of your fellow?
Oh, her name is Marlene Bluestein, and she's currently at Tucson at the VA hospital.
Uh-huh. There. And was you were dependent upon the grant money was ample enough so that you could do these things? And
right.
Who was head of the VA hospital then? Or didn't it
they
matter?
Had acting it? Heads. When Kunin left, I think medical director, or head of medicine, I think Bill Craig was acting director for a while, and then they brought Walt Sundstrom over.
But did that matter?
Didn't have anything to do with it.
I see.
But we were very independent, but there was something complicating the whole business. Kunin got two grants. He got money for the fellowship. He also got monies to put in place this assessment capability and service capability. I mean, you can say you want to do it, but you need monies to hire people and to support faculty who are going to have people training in PT and nutrition, etc., involved in a program. And you needed to pay for coordinator. So he did get a grant to do that from the VA, and this grant provided a core of staff that could man an outpatient clinic, that could man a home care program, that could be involved in offering this setting as a practicum for people being trained in nutrition and physical therapy and pharmacy and nursing and medicine if they would want to elect to do so. And that... I mean, those two pots of money were very well integrated, continue to be so. VA is very into interdisciplinary programs. They think that's the cat's pajamas. And so they funded a lot of those around the country. And they've been very generous with what they staff them with. The only problem is outside there's very few money, very little monies to have the same kind of staffing. And there's no way you can reimburse for much of the kinds of services that are in these interdisciplinary units. There's just no way of doing it within most clinical settings because you can't charge for them. And an institution has to be willing to take a loss by having a comprehensive group of resources, and that's very difficult for them to do. You can't charge directly for them. Well, after 2 years of educating ourselves and having a lot of hands-on experience and learning by doing, by using the models that are available in some of the places in the country, we finished. Now, I should backtrack a little bit. Most of the geriatric training in this country has been this bootstrap kind of training. There was no place to train geriatricians except by interest until the VA program, I think, was among the first. There were one or two fellowship resources through Kellogg, I think, and through Robert Wood Johnson, a Kaiser Foundation, but there really was no faculty anyplace, except for those isolated institutions which brought over an Englishman to start something, and there are very few of those. The ones that came over, I can name them on one or two fingers. So most of the programs were started by staff who had an interest and therefore were willing to try and put together something and hope that it would then blossom and take off the way most specialties have taken off in this country. Mm. That's been the tradition of medicine.
Crux of the story,
right,
isn't it?
Right. So all the grand old men in this country are people who have no geriatric training. Mm. The ones in England, the grand old men, the first ones had no geriatric training in 40 and 48, and when the public health service started, I mean the health service started, and most of the grand names just found themselves in geriatric settings and became expert. But when I went over, they had already had programs, in existence, and I have a feeling that a couple of the men that I studied with had no formal training, even though they were now training us formally. So it's not that out of line. But when I finished, that's the first time you asked me what did I think I was going to do. That was the first time I really sat back and said, what am I going to do? Where am I going to find a place for myself? Where can I really now practice what I supposedly have set out to train myself to do?
This is 1981.
Yeah, it was in, I started to think in late 1981. The Department of Medical School of Medicine had absolutely nothing. They just didn't see the need. We've been taking care of the elderly all of, what do we really need you for? And there are no monies. I mean, you can't expect us to take out of our budget and create something for you. And I also checked every place in town. I went to all the major clinics. And they really weren't interested at all. And they weren't certainly interested in a woman at that time. There were very few women in practice in the city in 1981. You could count them. Mm. They were either pediatricians or gynecologists, period. So I started to look around the country because, indeed, we represented the first generation of graduates from formal programs, and there were a lot of other institutions that appreciated they needed to start something formal. And the feds, in 19, I'm not sure if it was 79 or 80, started to come up with ways of supporting medical schools and new programs in medical schools because they knew that no one was going to take money out of standing budgets. So the NIA, which was organized in 76, I believe it is, so it's a very young institute.
That's National Institute for the Aging.
On Aging, right. Very young institute. One of the first things it did was organize monies that they call Geriatrics Medicine Academic Awards. And these were to be given to faculty members to enable them to put in place some formal kind of program. Not necessarily for fellows, which they could do, but something right in the guts of the medical school that would try and address the medical curriculum, the undergraduate curriculum, residency training, and also set up prototypic programs. So they realized they needed to do something. So what I did in 1980-81, I decided, well, I had nothing to lose, and since they claim there's no monies, I'll see if I can't get an award. So I wrote an application describing a program that would suit this institution. And in the meanwhile, I was still looking for, I must have interviewed at 5 or 6 different places around the country. I was offered about 3 of them, even though I had 0 experience, you know, fresh out of school. But the problem with Howard, you know, coordinating things, in fact, I was offered 4 of them. It just, nothing quite meshed. It was just a chaotic time. However, he would have moved if I could have gotten something. Even if it wasn't optimal, he would have found some place that would have made a spot for him.
This is take 2 of the interview with Elaine Leventhal.
I was offered positions at Case Western and at Rush and Texas. I can't remember. A couple of others. And just nothing seemed quite right. And I sort of was hemming and hawing about what we were going to do. Howard was interested in going to, we would have gone to, I think, Chicago, because there was a probability that he would take a position at either Illinois or at Chicago. But I got the grant. So with this grant in hand, with this monies in hand, the medical school agreed to allow me to start a program. They said that they would provide no obstructions. However, they weren't going to give me any help either. Whatever I could do.
Provide no obstructions.
No obstructions. That's exactly what it was all about. And whatever would happen would be the result of my own efforts. And I decided, well, I might as well give it a whirl.
Now, whom did you talk to about that?
Well, it was the dean, the chairman of the Department of Medicine.
Brown,
chairman of the Department of Medicine. Donald Harkness. Walter Sundstrom, head of the VA program. And head of the hospital.
What was their attitude to you?
And, well, they said, oh, this is fine and great. We need this. Wonderful. However, we just can't give you any help. The other person who was very supportive was David Kindig, at that time vice chancellor, but with absolutely no power, and the head of the hospital. And the head of the hospital, Gordon Durazon, said he appreciated the need and that they would help me get a clinic started by providing some monies for a nurse until my grant really got going. And so he did do that, though they gave me a clinic on Friday afternoons. Now, Friday afternoons, is the only reason I got that is because no one else wanted to be in the space on Friday afternoons. And Friday afternoons is a terrible time to see anybody because if you have to do anything, you never get your results back. You have to put someone in the hospital. Nothing happens for the week over the weekend. It's just... But I was grateful for any little crumb that we got. And so with the verbal support of all these people, finally found a place to have a clinic. Actually, Walt Sundstrom told me I could use a room in the rheumatology clinic on Friday afternoons because it wasn't being used. There was no space in medicine, supposedly, or anything like that. I mean, just no place. And I started, I got to work.
Were you given an appointment?
Yeah, I was an assistant professor.
You were?
Yeah.
When did that start?
81.
So that this was part of it?
This was all part of it. They gave me an appointment as an assistant professor on the CHS track, the non-tenured track. I had been an instructor when I was a fellow because we did a lot of teaching. Mm. So I got an assistant professorship. And I got money from the hospital for a part-time nurse so that we could put something in place. And I was given... There were no offices in the medical school. They just had no room for me. So the dean of the nursing school, who was a very staunch supporter, Val Prock, said that she had some extra offices and I could have an office in the nursing school. So my first office was in the nursing school on the second floor of the nursing school. And one of the first things that happened was that I was appointed to a task force by the vice chancellor that was to look at geriatrics and the needs of geriatrics at the CSC. And Val Prock chaired that task force.
CSC?
Clinical Science Center, the hospital, and the medical and the health professional schools.
Uh-huh. What does the rest of us call it? Center for Health Science, CHS.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
All right. Who set up this task force?
The vice chancellor.
David his own Kingdon. Initiative? Or?
Yes, I think so. It was a need that he saw, and so as his function as the vice chancellor, he called this task force.
Sometime, but it, only when it becomes appropriate, I would like you to bring in whatever role the fame Macbeth Institute and people connected with that, but don't bring it in.
Oh, that's different. That's a very different bag of wax. Yeah.
All right.
It had really nothing to do with this at all. By that time, it had kind of faded. It had no real role. And it had very little.
So you were really on your own on campus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Faye Macbeth. Martin Loeb had asked me to join the Faye Macbeth when I was a fellow. And he had always felt that there was zero cooperation with the medical center and the Aging Institute. I mean, there was no one was willing to participate, and they really never did much of anything in terms of dialogue or participation in anything. So I did join it back then, but I wasn't in a position to do anything as a fellow. I mean, it was just sort of... I was positionless and powerless. But I did have an opportunity to at least see what it was all about. The Institute at that time very much reflected Martin and his orientation and had relatively little that it could interact with in terms of the basic sciences and the hospital. I mean, he was very biased against medical models, and it was very much social work, social model kind of orientation, and everything they did was there, and that's one of the reasons it just faded. They got very little support, and because they had no breath, and they just weren't able to sustain themselves. It was not truly an institute in the graduate school sense. But this task force called by Kindig was made up of people from the hospital, from the medical school, nursing school, from the health service providers, and some people on the campus. And I think they did an excellent job looking at needs in terms of service, in terms of education, in terms of research, and came out with a series of recommendations, appreciated the need for faculty for some sort of coordinated effort. And from that task force came a DIN proposal, which went from the chancellor's office to the legislature. And I will say that even though I was a lowly assistant professor, I was very active in that task force. I did participate. I played a role in drafting several of the recommendations.
Who were the people that were most effective and helpful?
I think Val was very helpful. Peter Prusing, I'd have to look at the list again. John Fallon from Basic Science. We worked very hard on getting these things going. I was particularly, I suppose I had less of other kinds of responsibilities and a real vested interest that I found myself involved as much as I did. Well, this DIN was submitted to the legislature, and it was cut, but there was funding approved for 2 years to essentially buy faculty that could become a core for geriatrics and faculty in medicine and in nursing and in some of the social sciences. I think there was one position that was bought or that was filled, and I do not know what happened to the rest of the money.
What year was this?
Was that 82, 83, something like that? How did the biennials run? But something around.
I think they're the odd years.
So it must have been 83, yeah. Don't ask me where it went. There was supposedly a search committee to try and bring in someone to head the geriatrics program, someone who would be visible nationally, which I thought was wonderful. And I was very anxious that they get in someone who could truly be a mentor, who would be able to bridge the different units in the medical center, and that was visible enough so that we could build a nucleus around that person that would also, by virtue of being visible, would be in a position to start developing some research units. And I gave them a lot of names of people who were really quite prominent and identified as prominent geriatricians.
Gave whom?
The search committee, of whom the chairman of medicine was, I'm not sure, I think Dave Featherman and Don Harkness were on the committee, and they asked me for lists, and I gave it to both of them.
So this was a committee that was
appointed
from the task force.
Right, that was appointed by through the vice chancellor's office to help with recruiting.
The vice chancellor for health science.
Right, yeah. Right. To assist in recruiting. And I was very strongly in favor of them bringing in someone who could bring together the resources of the university with that of the VA. The people at the VA, since I was the first person out, were really very concerned that I was trying to put together something that smacked of too much control and power. They really thought that they didn't want me coming in and telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. I was very concerned about the fact that there was no mentoring over there, that there was no good medical staffing, that people didn't work very hard. There was no real research structure that was growing and that could be a basis for developing much more impact and much stronger ties to the research people on the campus. I saw all these as great opportunities. They were very content just doing their home care stuff and having this little interdisciplinary team, and I really thought that the only way something is going to grow is if you start putting together all your resources into something so that the sum is greater than any of the parts. Well, that was seen as very aggressive, and my standards were too high and all this kind of business. The coordinator of the VA program is a social worker, who I really felt was very happy in what she was doing. She loved her cushy job and really didn't want a physician coming in and telling what to do. So it's very nice not having any medical staff at that time over there. I think there's enormous sexist bias, and the staff at the VA very hostile to women. I mean, they very much biased against it. I wanted to backtrack a minute. you asked me something about the VA. In the beginning, when these programs were first put in place by Cunin, the chief of staff was not an internist, and still is not an internist. The chief of staff, which is the highest medical person in administration at the VA, is a surgeon. And this particular surgeon is very hostile to anything that smacked of geriatrics. He didn't want the programs there in the first place. He thought they were totally meaningless and useless.
Who
and
was
so
this?
His name is James Whiffen, and he's still there. And so he was very much, he was an obstruction to getting anything off the ground. Well, Cunin did it despite him. Then when Cunin left, there was really no one to fight Whiffen. So there was really no medical support for what was going on. So that, therefore, the people who had this little interdisciplinary team could just do their own thing because there was very little medical input. Whiffen became accepting of a geriatric service and clinical resources when central office of the VA insisted it had to happen. So he's done it despite himself. And so the VA medical people have never been tremendously supportive and certainly didn't want to see anything that was going to grow and become a strong bridge over to the university. And then the sexist bias is very, very real there, and I'm not paranoid about that. That is very real. There are the very strong feelings on the part of the director of medicine and his staff that, you know, they think that you can have a woman nominally in head of something, but not a woman who wants to do something. So that was a real barrier. We had some outside people come in to address the needs of the university in terms of geriatric programming when they were looking for someone as part of the search committee, and brought in some very good people. And one of the dear souls was one of the first people to build a program at Harvard. And he was very clear and stated all the things that we had been saying here that we needed, except he told them they really needed a man to do it, and that just sort of reinforced their particular biases. So I said, fine, albeit, if that's what you want, I don't really care. I don't need to run the whole thing. I want someone who is good, that will be a real support and a colleague. I need colleagues. I don't care who's sitting where. I don't have a need to be an administrator. What I have a need to do is to develop something that has some sort of substance. But I desperately want a good colleague, and I want someone who has more credibility than I do, because I'm not very visible. I'm just starting, and if you're going to have someone in to sit over a program, then it should be someone that has visibility. That's the only criteria. Well, they couldn't find anybody, and the money's disappeared.
Well, surely somebody has asked about it.
Yeah, but I'm not privy to the answers that were provided.
You don't have you aren't in a position to ask?
No.
Even privately?
The dean, I don't know what he did with the monies. Now, I think since the time of the task force, and you asked me about the Fay McBeath Institute, the Aging Institute has become an entity on this campus, whereas it really wasn't at the time of that original task force. And as you know, sits in the graduate school, and its director is Dave Featherman from the sociology department. David has tried very hard to put together a credible kind of institute, one that would have a broad base throughout the campus, not just social work, broad base, and bring in the biological and the social sciences, and also the clinical sciences. And he has, you know, tried very hard and succeeded in certain ways, though has not been able to succeed in other ways because of the way in which this campus is structured. And he has been in a position to look at what has happened to these monies, because a lot of the appointments, the campus appointments, were made through the Institute, or could have been made through the Institute. And as far as I understand it, he has not been able to find out what happened to those monies. So I'm not, you know, there is currently a report which he has just prepared to go to the deans and of the graduate school and not sure where, and the medical school about the institute and what it has done over the last 7 years and current status and new directions. And he makes several comments about the fact that the medical school has been unable to put a significant program in place, has been unwilling to really provide backing and resources to develop geriatric medicine here. So in that report, it's very clear. And it will be available, I would expect, within the next month or so.
Available?
Will
it be publicized?
I don't know what happens to reports like that, but certainly it's being sent to the dean. And as part of the executive committee, I am on the executive committee of the institute. I have seen the report, and it's really quite telling about the lack of cooperation from the medical school in terms of building a program within its own walls and also collaborating with the rest of the campus in building geriatric, whatever it is that we're supposed to build here, gerontology.
Yeah. So you think it is the dean, not the vice chancellor?
Oh, it's not the vice chancellor. No, the problems have not been at the vice chancellor's office. Mm-hmm. The problem with the vice chancellor's office is that they have no power because they don't control the monies, really. Mm-hmm. At least, from my vantage point, I think that's the case. I don't think that they have been the obstruction. I think the obstruction has been at the dean level and the departmental levels. The department doesn't think it's worth anything for them to put any of their resources into a program. Damn tootin'. And then even if there's no longer any money because the grant is up, they would much prefer to continue to bill in cardiology and in hematology because those are the areas that they see as most glamorous and that generate the highest clinical revenues. See, we're in a double bind in medicine. You're in a bind with respect to where can you get extramural monies for research and where do you get monies to run the clinical setting and to pay your faculty. Because your faculty is not paid in the same way that the academic faculty is paid. They're paid with an academic salary, but then they are also paid for the clinical service that they render. So, it's just more complicated in terms of, what drives the school. Mm-hmm. It's just driven a little differently than the academic departments.
Does this mean that that you haven't been able to do anything specific about aging since?
No. It doesn't mean that. It means that I have been able to do those things that I could pull off myself. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been able to facilitate growth, to see us really expanding, to see us bring in other kinds of clinicians and researchers so that we could have more of a role in education and research. And to forge ties to the campus by virtue of having more bodies to be involved in more research. That we haven't had enough people around to offer certain clinical services which would better serve the community and also serve as training sites for physicians and nurses because there aren't enough of us to do all the things that we're asked to do. There are enormous demands for all kinds of innovative programming in terms of service. Oh, we just can't do it. It's impossible. There's only one, or two of us who just can't do it. The hospital has been very anxious to make us very visible, but we can't provide the service that they're advertising. I'm not willing to agree to something if I can't follow through. I mean, they wanted me to circuit ride all over the place to do consulting and to do all kinds of things.
Over the state?
Yeah, how can I do it? It's totally impossible. I did it once or twice, and I thought I was going to die. I mean, physically, it's not fair to say that you want to fill a need if you really haven't got the personnel to do it. And we just can't grow because there's no monies to recruit.
I know you've given lots of talks and you've had workshops. And
right, but that's not the only... What they really want is someone to be a consultant, to go and be a consultant to other physicians in terms of complicated management. It's a wonderful way to teach, to take people along with you. to help a local community as part of the outreach from the university develop more resources in their own setting to better serve their elderly population. That's very much a part of what we have to do. But you can't do it unless there's enough personnel to do it properly.
Does Extension do anything like this?
Well, Extension can't provide medical services without doctors doing it. I mean, you can't do it. Mm. I mean, Extension can have a workshop for people who run sheltered housing, but that's not quite the same thing. Okay. I mean, that's not what I need to do.
And what about the legislature? I mean,
they haven't given. They didn't provide money in the next round budget.
But they did at one point.
And then it wasn't renewed.
They never said what happened.
They must have. But I don't know about that. I'm not sitting in the right place to know what happens. All I know is it was not approved the next round. So obviously someone looked and saw it wasn't used properly, and they didn't continue. That's the dilemma. These are the reasons why, when an opportunity to relocate into a medical school that says they really want us to come and will give us support to grow, and a legislature that says they are very anxious to address the needs of the aging population in the state, and therefore want very much to look at ways in which new program can be developed. When the dean of the medical school says we have to look at our curriculum and people in other departments or other schools say we want to start thinking about gerontological teaching in our own schools, when that kind of offer comes along, that's kind of exciting.
That's from Rutgers.
Right, right. They have a graduate institute on health policy and aging that has guts. That institute has hard monies to recruit fellows into the institute.
This is run by David McKenna?
That's right. That's how we created an institute. He said the only way he's going to have anything that's going to be able to be a creative institute is to have hard monies with appointments in home departments, but that the monies for the recruitments are part of the institute's resources, and they're hard, they're firm appointments. And so you can put together a very exciting group of people from history and economics and anthropology and sociology and psychology and medicine in an environment in which you can do things together, dialogue and address problems. And it's the thought is very challenging.
And is nobody here concerned that you're leaving with?
I do think that the graduate school and LNS is concerned they're losing Howard. I think they really are. And they've tried to look at ways to keep us, but the medical school doesn't really care. They really don't think that they'll have any trouble finding someone else to do what I do. They don't think that what I do really makes that much difference. I have, because of the lack of support, I haven't put my grants in through the medical school. We've put our grants in through the Institute on Aging. And so they haven't gotten much overhead from me after my academic award. But I didn't think they're giving me anything in return, whereas the Institute has provided a setting in which we could interact with people on the campus. And so I saw that as much more important for me and a way to support the Institute to keep it as viable as possible because of the structure of institutes here and has no other way of being viable. Mm. I felt more morally obligated to push for that than to push something in my own department. I don't get that much way in the way of rewards from my own department. So the medical school, I suppose the dean just is not someone with a great deal of vision. He has never had any vision. He's a nice man. He's a very pleasant man. He's not a vicious man, but he has no vision and really doesn't feel like he needs to do anything. So, we're leaving.
Let's, we have a little more time.
Yeah.
Talk about the other part of your work, which has been, I mean, you've been a clinical...
Clinically.
What do you call yourself?
Well, clinician.
The clinician,
oh,
yes.
Yeah. Well, the things that I was able to, I have put a lot of things in place here. In fact, we have probably as much going here as I do in most other places in terms of the medical school without any resources. And that's been, you know, very rewarding. I did get required course materials into the medical school curriculum. Most schools have just elective courses in the fourth year, but we actually have space in the required curriculum. I sat on a curriculum task force that called by the dean of the medical school, and they agreed there needed to be some changes in the curriculum. And so we have had some impact there. We have a very comprehensive geriatric educational component in the residency training, which is very good, and which our residency training curriculum is being adopted by the country. It's being published in the Annals of Internal Medicine as a prototypic program. So that's very real. I've had an appointment in the School of Nursing since the beginning, which Val Prak felt very strongly about, and I have taught every year in the graduate nursing program. They have given master's level degrees in geriatric nurse practice for a nurse practitioner course, and I teach in a seminar on geriatric medicine and problem solving. It's really clinical aspects of geriatrics there, and that's been a lot of fun. I've, in fact, had the opportunity to work with several of the graduates of that program come through our clinic, and we've worked very closely together. It's been excellent dialogue. I've participated in a variety of other teaching requests in a variety of the professional schools. But the long-term ongoing commitment has been to medicine and to nursing. So that's very real. We have a very successful clinic. We've started as an outpatient clinic. I was very anxious not to step on anybody's toes. I didn't want to take patients from anyone. I wanted to be able to show that a geriatric clinic could deal with issues in a slightly different way than my internist colleagues had dealt with them. I wanted to show that we could indeed expand the clinical base in internal medicine. And I wanted to make clear to colleagues in other specialties that we did have something unique to offer. So when we first started our clinic on that Friday afternoon, I sent letters describing what I did to every subspecialty, including surgical subspecialties. And also, we advertised our clinic, our consulting clinic, publicly, because we wanted people to know that they could self-refer, that you didn't need a referral from another physician to come to the university, and we were very willing to provide second opinions, and we didn't expect to primarily be a primary care clinic, but rather would wear several hats, and that people could come, physicians could refer, and we could together come up with some recommendations. We expected the care to really remain in the referring physician's hands. And we grew from one afternoon to a 5-day-a-week clinic. The only monies we did find, because the clinical demands were growing from the department, was we brought in another geriatrician as a clinical person. The hospital has provided a nurse practitioner. We've never had a full-time one, but we have pieces and bits. And so we have a very active clinic, and with inpatient consultation services tied into it. And we refuse to have any inpatient beds because there's just no way we could staff it. And there aren't any beds anyway that you could get. But there's just no way one person could staff beds in a hospital when they could be filled at any one of 365 days during the year. You need enough of a staff in order to provide the proper coverage. We have in our clinic an actual rotation for residents. They are assigned to us as part of their regular medicine scheduling, which again is very unique and works extremely well. So clinically, we have a very active ambulatory care facility. We also, in the beginning, provided all of the medical care to the Dane County home. At the time when we started, the home had a very large nursing home component. And it had two components, the chronically mentally ill hospital and the nursing home. As you know, Jonathan Barry decided, was about 3 or 4 years ago, that the county could not afford to continue to operate a nursing home, and he phased it out. So at the time of the phase-out, I felt that I no longer had to go to the county home as part of that long-term care service, but my colleague still continued to go until it essentially closed. Mm. There just didn't need to be so many of us as you start cutting out the population. So it was, again, an opportunity for training of students and house staff to deal with what are quite different problems in the chronic setting. Now we take our students and house staff to freestanding nursing homes in the area. So we do provide training because we all have patients, long-term patients in nursing homes in the area. So, again, part of the teaching of medical students and house staff, which is not something you find every place. So we've had an impact on the curriculum of the medical students and the postgraduate trainees. The fellowship program still is functioning at the VA, and we have a rotation of the VA fellows through the university clinics. That's, again, part of what has continued. So educationally and clinically, we have really some excellent services where we have increasing demand for care, and we have a great deal of trouble meeting the demand. I mean, we have long waiting times to get into the clinic, even though we have people available almost 5 days a week. So that's been quite impressive, considering the scarcity of bodies, and we've had very few people to carry this clinical load.
Is this the same as the internal medicine clinic?
No, it's a separate clinic within internal medicine. You notice the signs say general internal medicine and geriatrics. Mm. So it's a separate unit. They count our heads, when they keep numbers on who comes through, they do keep separate figures.
Well, how do they decide whether somebody's going to the geriatric clinic?
Well, they know who people say, and they tell you who they're going to see.
And it depends on the doctor.
On the doctor
so
and
one
how
sees
the doctor.
You, one's in the geriatric clinic, is that right?
Well, yes and no. I wear a little smidgen of a hat of internal medicine. Oh. I do have younger patients. That's a complication of this institution, which is another reason why the Rutgers was so attractive. With the start of the HMO, everybody's clinical practice in general internal medicine changed. And as a good soldier, I didn't feel that I could refuse to see patients that wanted to come into the clinic if they wanted to see me if they weren't over 65. And I also like to see younger patients. So we suddenly found ourselves with very much increased rosters.
That was, you're merely talking about the increase in numbers.
Right. So that suddenly I had many more people wanting to come in and be seen, and those are not geriatric patients. Yeah. So we do separate them out. I mean, we have a way of tallying who is in what category. Yeah. I think we think this. There are a lot of things that we could talk about there, which have been some of the reasons why we couldn't grow the way we should grow, and some of the reasons why we're as inefficient as we are.
What? then?
Oh, it has to do with how they're really willing to allocate resources, that we can't make best use of our time and our resources. And it inhibits us from going off into a variety of other directions and expanding our services.
And this is the whole thing, but also internal medicine, yeah. Particularly.
And how the hospital sets up the clinics. Mm. And what kind of resources they're willing to allocate into that setting, and where they're willing to put their money.
Can you give specific examples?
Well, they won't add to any of the staff until the demand gets so great that we become immobilized. Mm. And of course, that is very destructive. We have enormous turnover, and where we need extra bodies is not where we get them. I could be more efficient if I had more people up front. Or if I had more room. We're being squeezed out of rooms because the specialties have higher priority.
When you say people up front, you mean the nurses and the
receptionists? Exactly. They're big bottlenecks. And they're big bottlenecks because we don't have rooms to see patients. And pulmonary, which shares a hall with us, wants all of our rooms when they're there. And they're just not providing enough physical space.
Is there space somewhere else, or there just isn't enough space altogether?
I think, there are certain specialties which take more than their fair share. Their priorities are screwed up, to be blunt. A lot of politicking, too. Mm-hmm. It's just they're very reactive instead of being proactive. Very slow, very cumbersome to move the institution to do things, to jump on things.
And do you have any idea whether this is endemic to medical schools, hospitals, or is it unique to UW?
Well, I think it's probably not that unique. It has a lot to do with how the monies to run the hospital are generated and the kind of support from the legislature and the fact that they've been the legislative imperative puts us at an enormous disadvantage. And the Medicare formulae, for some crazy reasons, are calculated at different levels for different kinds of institutions, and we've been killed. And I don't understand why. Nobody understands why.
We, the UW Hospital.
Yeah. You look at the formulae around the country, and we get less on the dollar than a lot of those small private institutions, and it has to do with dirty politics. I mean, it's local town gang politics. And the state has not been willing to underwrite as many of the expenses and programs here as they should. At other state institutions, there's much more of a commitment to maintain the teaching hospital than there is here. Here, there's this egalitarian, way of looking at things insists that we have to compete with the private sector. And we really can't in certain ways. When you have to train medical students and house staff, there are certain things that are different in the setting, and it's costly. Plus the fact that we have always had the tradition of being the tertiary referral hospital, and these referral patterns have changed now. And we get dumped on. So that it's amazing to see what comes into the hospital. And that's not appreciated by people in the legislature. They really don't understand what that means. Unless you're in it, you don't see the composition of the population.
But isn't the university lobbyist supposed to convey that sort of thing?
Well, they're not very effective. They have really been kind of lousy with that. How good have the lobbyists of the university been with the legislature? It's really not been that good. There's been a lot of hostility to the university and the legislature, and it spills over to the hospital as well. And the private sector lobbies are very strong. So this makes life more complicated. I'm not supposed to be plugged in anymore. You're not recording.
Listening,
though. You are. Excuse me.
I turned it back on again.
We for the last 2 years have been running a very large deficit at the hospital because the Medicare reimbursement formula is instead of being 80 cents on the dollar, it's been 50 cents on the dollar. And we get a large indigent population. we get referred people who run up enormous bills, even though we do have insurance cushion over, I can't remember what the ceiling, the cap is. It's a large amount of money, but we still lose while people are in until they reach the cap. We get sent things like, you know, all the transplants are sent into our HMO. We have bone marrow and kidney transplants in an HMO. Something's wrong with that. But that means that the other HMOs appreciate the expense and therefore very rapidly shift over their high-cost patients if they can convince them to come down here. We have a very large burden of cancer patients in our HMO, which pushes costs up and become enormous losses for the university. We're relatively efficient as an institution, but it's expensive to provide this kind of care. Right, and so it's really, and we have enormously low incidence of problems here. I mean, I see the numbers, and we really run very well. The care, the quality of care is very good. There are very few incidences of problems occurring in medical care here. You do not see some of the problems that occur in other institutions because of some of the ways in which funding is structured. At the medical college, at the county, Milwaukee County, there is a cap on $50,000 on suits that can be brought against staff for problem malpractice or things of that sort. So you never see anything that happens. You really don't know what happens over there because of that kind of cap. At the U, the cap is $250,000. That's the cap the state sets. So the county has a different cap. And we have very few complaints against us. They're very small, very low compared to the rest of the country, which is impressive. So the overall, the care is good, but we run into problems of budgeting and reimbursement and how you divide up where the monies go and the allocation of disproportionately large amounts of money for the surgical services and for the tertiary fancy stuff and relatively little money for the primary care ambulatory services. And yet that's the major gateway into the hospital now that we have to provide HMO kind of care. Mm. And we have very, very restricted plant with relatively few clerical people that are pushed to the limit. We have enormous turnover in our clerical and nursing assistant help because they work so hard.
And they get fed up and go somewhere else.
Right, right. The addition of a few people in that kind of setting would make the physicians more efficient because things would move more quickly, and if there was more physical space to see patients, we could really deal with what's an increased load and also fulfill an obligation which we cannot do now, which is teach. We can't... I thought I heard a step. That wasn't. We cannot teach in the ambulatory setting, even though that has to become something that we must deal with, because there's no room to put a student in with a patient. We haven't got the physical space to let the medical students rotate.
How did that happen? I mean, the hospital's relatively new.
Well, I think, I wasn't here at the time, but I think that when the hospital was designed, it was anticipated that there would be several phases of growth in the physical plant. Mm-hmm. And that they would put up phase one, and then they would be able to do two and three, and there would be you would fit in the clinics and everything else as you built these extra additions. And I think after the first unit was okayed, and they put the hole in the ground, I think the legislature put a clamp on the planning for phase two and three. So they had to redesign the interior of the hospital and put in more beds, so more in-house space, and they took that from the clinical space because now there are fewer hospital units being used and they've moved some of the clinics around, but we still don't have enough space to accommodate what has become an increasingly ambulatory kind of practice. Mm-hmm. And they are planning on moving some of the clinics out to the Brickyard. They're building a building. But general medicine is not scheduled to move. At this point, there's no place for them to go because of the demands for parking are much greater than any of the specialty clinics, and a lot of logistics. And also, I think there's a political pressure from the community not to have the general internists expand. It's seen as a real threat, a competitive threat to the people in town. So there's a lot of that kind of murk around also. As you know, a lot of the private practitioners in town are feeling enormous pressure from the HMOs, and some of the solo people are doing very poorly. And so there's a lot of problems in terms of medicine here in the city. Mm. And it just prevents the U from being as innovative as they should be. DRGs have made an enormous impact on revenues. And the feds have also done something else. Those are the categories for reimbursement that have been put in place by the feds for all Medicare patients. Mm. They are only willing to pay an average fee, a fee which is supposedly the average of what's charged around the country for a particular diagnosis. And if you have someone who is more complicated and stays longer, then the hospital loses money because they're only paid for X number of days. And if they stay instead of 5 days, 8 days, the hospital loses. They stay less, the hospital makes money. So the complicated patient is not looked on kindly, and that's where we get transfers. The older patient invariably requires more care, and therefore, and there's nothing built into the formula to take into account age or chronic illness. Mm-hmm. This has really changed hospitalizations. You're also seeing people discharged too early before they're fully recovered. Mm. That's changed all of the kinds of things I have to deal with as an in the outpatient setting. It's had an impact on nursing homes, a different issue entirely. So that's also put a crimp on the hospitals, plus something else very important has happened. In 1983, there was an omnibus bill passed, which not only set in place these DRGs, but also did something else. It also changed the formulae for paying of residency education. And it stated that there was going to be a phasing out of the amounts of monies that academic institutions with residency programs were going to get for training of residents. These monies come as a percentage of Medicare fees. And they're slowly being cut down, and with the expectation they're going to be cut off. Now, who's going to pay for residency training? I'm not sure. But they were being cut to 80%, and then 2 years later to 50%, et cetera, and so on. The only area that was being paid at full level was geriatrics. Now, I know that geriatric medicine in this institution gets no monies at full rank. I mean, it's just spread. It just comes in and it's spread around to all the training programs. So that's had an enormous effect also on the commitment to house staff. Now, what this is going to be in the long run, I don't know. So obviously, to keep an active house staff, you're going to have revenues from other places pay for that. It's very, very complicated. It's getting very murky. And that's beyond anything that's really relevant for what I do. Mm. Except that there should be monies to pay for a fellow for me from those revenues. And there has been, we've had a lot of problems filling. I didn't want to take just anybody, so that's a different issue. I have had a fellow that was very successful. And then because I didn't see any way of bringing together the VA program and the U program to recruit separately makes no sense. So I said, I really think this is becoming kind of an exercise in futility to try and run two separate programs and try and do things independently. It's much better for me to put my efforts into maintaining what I have, into maintaining the educational thing, to running our clinic and really trying to devote as much as I can to my research program. Which, of course, we haven't talked about at all. that I just decided that I would ask to have the monies from that supposedly allocated for a fellow for us put into the general pool, and that those monies would just buy fellows that would rotate through the two programs and spend some clinical time here. And that's essentially where we've left it.
Well,
should we stop then?
I think we probably better.
Okay.
We tape and have the time.
Okay. Things around in the summer. That's a very good idea.
Our video's set. This is take three of the interview with Elaine Leventhal. And do you have what to add, or are you going to start talking about your research?
We were talking about what actually is the geriatric program here. I mean, did I manage to put together since 1981? And I told you about the curriculum that has changed, the impact we've had on the curriculum and the clinic. And the clinic has been extremely successful. There was a lot of... We were talking about the hospital. The hospital has seen a real shift in its referral patterns because of the HMOs. And the need for many of the institutions that previously had seen the U as its major tertiary referral center shift to a couple of the other facilities in the area because of the relationships built into the HMO system. St. Mary's has developed an extraordinarily widely flung set of affiliations with small clinics and hospitals by virtue of tying their insurance programming and HMO insurance into the rural hospital cooperative. And they actually gave money to the rural health cooperative before the HMO was started, to help them put it in place, with the only stipulation be that they be the major referral hospital. So what had traditionally been avenues or conduits to the U shifted over, even though St. Mary's is not the university hospital. This has put a real crimp in certain services and the filling of certain services, and this has happened a couple of other ways too. Well, the hospital, as part of the Wisconsin idea, as part of the role of the university in extending to provide education without walls, a university without walls, has always provided health services and educational, medical education and nursing education around the state. And the medical staff has, in the past, been, quote, circuit riding, in which they would go and provide consultative services at a variety of institutions. Well, this has shifted, and the university at the hospital has made a very active effort to create new kinds of relationships and strengthen ones which have remained, quote, loyal to the U as part of the system. And they have tried to get a commitment from me to provide geriatric consultative services to Southwest and Wisconsin and other places. That was very exciting in terms of being able to help educate the practitioners in the community and, again, set up a variety of referral avenues for specific assessment here at the U. The only problem is that one person can't do this. And one person who has a colleague whose time is primarily devoted to manning the clinic cannot provide the service. It's just impossible. So as we were mentioning before, those efforts are very grand on paper, but really can't be pulled off unless there are more revenues available to provide the personnel. Well, these have been relatively successful and only limited by bodies, by numbers of bodies. But the other hat that I have worn here, and which I felt was probably the most important hat that I had to wear as someone committed to academics, is to develop a research program that would address geriatric issues. And for me, the most exciting time that I can spend is with patients, but also with patients who will help me to learn more about normal aging. And with a fellow that I had, I developed a couple of research studies which looked at the utilization of healthcare around the state, especially for the institutionalized old, and especially after change in reimbursement that followed this omnibus bill passage and DRGs. And that was just wonderful, having essentially a graduate student, even though he's a postdoctoral fellow, to work in a particular research area was a complete pleasure. And I realize how much I miss this kind of contact. It's one of the reasons that I have been so unhappy here, because the fellowship program has been primarily at the VA, and the VA really didn't want me to be part of their program. And I felt, therefore, I didn't want the hassle of dealing with trying to get a fellow and keeping things separate, and figured it was better for me to put my energies where I was having some success, which was the things I talked to you about. When I did have a fellow, I appreciate how much I miss, because it's just great, just wonderful. Again, it's a colleague, though a temporary colleague. And before Mark came along, I'd had several applicants for fellowship training, and I suppose because of the effort involved, it's not worth it for me to have anyone who walks in the door accepted into the program, because if I don't see the potential of this collegial kind of interaction, it's a real burden, and it doesn't help me do what I think is really necessary, which is train the next generation of academic geriatricians. Too many of the applicants into the geriatrics fellowship programs here and around the country have been people who just want to do clinical work, man a VA program or man a nursing home or something like that. There have been very, very few that have committed interest to academic research and academic appointments. So that was one of the reasons I didn't make much of a I really was anxious and didn't make much of a fuss when we melded the programs. But our research has been very, very interesting, and we have been able to bring in large amounts of money from the National Institutes on Aging to fund projects looking at the well elderly, and elderly who are patients in our clinic, and essentially having them teach us about how health behavior changes across the lifespan. And our the participants in our studies have been absolutely incredible. They are enthusiastic, very anxious to learn themselves about aging, and so have been marvelous to work with. And I think reflect on the success that our clinic has had, because people are so willing to be part of what are projects that take a great deal of their time. One of the programs we did, we interviewed people at a rate of about 1 to 1.5 hours apiece, minimum 5 to 6 times over 18 months, which is a lot of time. And we've now come back and asked them to come into the laboratory, because now we want to look at them physiologically. And there have been very few refusals. And we now put them in the lab for 2 and 3 hours at a time and have them hooked up to all kinds of polygraphic instrumentation. And they are very enthusiastic about what we do. So I see that again as an indication that there are opportunities to do all kinds of things on the campus. We can collaborate with a lot of people on the academic campus, but just about zilch cooperation with medical colleagues. There's essentially no dialogue between people. Very few people want to work outside their own labs, outside their own domains. And the reason that we've gotten to do as much as we have has been primarily because of people in the graduate school and LNS being much more open and receptive to cooperation. Though we essentially do almost all things within our own lab, still is a much more open kind of environment for exchange of ideas. Access to patients outside of the university-based clinical population is relatively limited. There again is a lot of the town gown barrier walls. There's so much competition for patients. There's so much fear on the part of people in the community that we're stealing patients, that it puts up a lot of obstacles. And of course, a lot of their fears are groundless. There's no way the university wants to or can provide most of the primary care in this catchment area. It's not meant to do that. It hasn't got the staff. And it's a tragedy that the way in which the health system has changed has produced a lot of interpersonal conflict in terms of town gown.
Well, that was always there, though.
No, but it's much worse. It's much worse.
Because of the HMO.
Yeah, it's just much worse. The atmosphere is just different. I mean, I've seen it over the last 5 years. It's really changed. There's been such a real shift in income for many of the people in the area. The HMOs have not been extremely successful. They've really lost a great deal of money, most of them. Just because you can't provide for some of the services that are promised at the cost that was, set. Mm. It's just impossible. Just can't do it. You don't have control over access into the system, and unfortunately a few sick people push, the cost for the whole organization off, even though most people are healthy. And HMOs should, if there was some way of controlling them, provide health maintenance, and people who are extremely ill should really have a different kind of umbrella coverage. And I don't know how one designs that fiscally. I'm not sure what else I could add.
You've worked with Howard.
Right.
I mean, you've gotten grants with him.
Right. My husband's work has been, most of his career has been looking at emotional behavior and working in health and health-related settings, because they truly are the real world that lets you understand how people respond to stress. He's always felt that the laboratory is fine and good for testing components of a model, but to really understand the impact of stress on behavior, one has to look not at the college sophomore, but at real stress-provoking settings. Mm. And so working in a variety of health settings has allowed him to come up with some very highly predictive models of behavior. And these models have then allowed the development of interventions that can really affect some behaviors which are not very adaptive. Well, Howard had never been particularly interested in aging issues. He's worked in some chronic disease settings, hypertension and cancer, but aging wasn't particularly in his frame of reference. But I think my talking about some of the dilemmas I saw and some of the challenges that I saw and some of the concerns that I had about how people really change as they get older. And there's this all this talk about old people using more of the health system and old people being the major drain. And I wasn't convinced that was really true, that I think we needed to look at that a little bit more carefully to understand whether really the elderly use the system more, or when they had needed the system, they were just more costly because they had more things wrong, which is a very different issue. And so we began developing a series of studies to ask some questions about health behaviors across the lifespan. And here again, this whole issue of developmental change, not only in biology, but also in emotional patterns and also in behaviors that one chooses to use to protect oneself under time of threat. But fascinating. And that's part of the projects that we are both co-PIs for and which we put through the Institute. We have had a very large grant on health behavior across the lifespan, which we, as I mentioned before, we chose to put through the Institute because we had a strong commitment to seeing the Institute successful. Mm. The Institute suffers because institutes are not something which are common on this campus, and there's no mechanism of providing some stability for institutes here. Institutes depend strictly on the largesse of the members to provide overhead from grants they're willing to put through them, which means that they then are penalized by home departments. So it's a real bind to have an institute really flourish. And the only reason the Institute on Aging has been relatively viable is because Dave Featherman did get a program project mainly made up of his colleagues in sociology of put through the Institute, looking at age-related issues from a sociological point of view. And they also put through a fellowship training grant through the Institute to do some graduate training for people in SOS and one psychologist. And then we put through our very large grant as a single project grant. And those have been the mainstays of support for the Institute. No one in medicine has put anything through, no, aside from me. Nobody in the biological sciences have put anything through. And unless the university rethinks where such an institute should sit...
It's under the graduate school?
It's under the graduate school. Or if there's some other way of giving it some kind of cushion so it can really serve a purpose of bringing very disparate... areas together to look at aging, because it's so fuzzy and diffuse, you know, and sits in so many places. Just very difficult to keep it cooking. It needs enough space and resources in order to make it worthwhile for people to use it.
Do you see any prospect of this? Have you talked?
I don't know. We've talked about the Well, that's this report that I mentioned makes these suggestions. And unless the regents are willing to rethink what it should be, I don't know if anything will happen.
Hmm.
Or legislation. I mean, I don't know where it has to come from, but it certainly monies have to come from someplace that are specifically earmarked to maintain this kind of relatively non-traditional structure. It just can't go. It also needs to have its base... In the academic campus, and it really should not have as its director a medical person, because medical people have not really ever been truly supportive or committed to making sure it doesn't die.
Is there to be a new director?
Yeah, Dave Featherman would like to step down. He's been director for 5 years, and so he has asked for a search committee to look for another director.
Mm.
And I feel very strongly it has to be someone... with real presence on the academic campus.
Mm-hmm.
because there's too much, that's where the real strength lies. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yes.
The Dean Bach, I think, had told Howard that if he would stay, he would like him very much to be the next director. But that's not enough of a carriage, you know, for us. Not the way things are. The Institute doesn't have any strength, and I don't, you know, I just don't see any real change in terms of anything in medicine until there's a new dean who decides that, yes, indeed, this is something that should go.
And Howard essentially left because the psychology department is not strong enough, and there are no colleagues in his area.
Well, there's no colleagues in his area. I mean, he's the only health psychologist. And the department is relatively small, and they don't see themselves building strength in what they see as applied areas, though Howard is not an applied psychologist. He's interested only using the applied setting, and he doesn't really do any applied work at all. People then take his models and use it for developing strategies and things, but Howard doesn't do that. But also, I think he doesn't see my position as changing, and it gets him sort of irritated. And he sees that our ability to use the clinical setting is very much hampered by the size of the geriatric program. So he gets himself all worked up about things like that. He would very much like to see a health psychology program that would bridge departments, that would include SOS and anthropology, plus also and so bring in students and also have a couple of colleagues, but there's just no likelihood that his department would hire. They just are not built that way. They just don't see themselves growing in that kind of way.
Did anybody at the medical school or health science center regret your going to speak?
Everybody has regretted I'm going that I meet, except my chairman has never felt that he wanted to stick out his neck to commit anything to what I do. He says all the right things, and he says he's supportive, but he is not willing to make waves. He's not willing to push the VA to know things, and he's not willing to take any resources from any place else.
You think he might have done this if he'd been a
different
kind of
person? He should have. If he had had guts, he would have said 7 years ago, we have an academic award. It's very hard to get monies to do anything for this program. The only way we're going to have anything is to put together two programs, and it has to be done. And I insist on it, and we have someone here who can do it. If we could bring someone else, let's try. If we can't, let's put things together and make it go. Now, if there are people who are against it, we have to find out why. If it's because they're biased, for whatever reason, then we have to see if that can't be alleviated in some way. But there should be an attempt to have some kind of growth. And if you have resources that you can pull in a way so you don't have to commit your own dollars, then do it. And nobody else wants to do this kind of thing, so why don't you let her do it?
Yeah.
It's not glamorous. I don't care about it. It's not blood. If it was blood, I would like it. He's a hematologist. But even so, just, let it happen. Or make sure that the dean doesn't lose the money. Make sure that the money's come. Yeah. But he just doesn't have any guts. So he hasn't really been a support at all. The section head of general internal medicine has been very supportive, but he has no power to do anything. So, that's been a problem.
Are there other good people who are leaving?
There's a lot of turnover. There is a lot of turnover. There's a lot of... The Department of Medicine is a very mediocre department. We have no good endocrinology. It's really rotten. We just lost one of the really hotshot young people. It's quite weak in certain areas because they just haven't filled it with strong people. They brought in a liver man who's such a jerk. And he's terrible with patients. And they should have let him go. The only reason they're keeping him is because he got a grant to do something. Well, he still is a very poor bet. It's really weak. He is not that strong. They have a couple of very good people, but then it's weak in other areas. Dean Moshe is very prominent, has enormous amounts of money, but a lot of his other colleagues are. Cantor is very good. It's very strong. But that's separate. It's even not part of medicine. Mm. Durham is part of medicine. It's very weak. Chemosurgery is strong, but that's surgery. It's not. Renal is an absolute disaster. They supposedly are recruiting. I don't know.
You're talking to a member of UCARE. This is alarming.
And so, you know, there's a lot of weak places. The overall care, I'm talking about from the research end, too. The research in these areas is zero.
Mm.
And that's because they won't go and recruit. And then they don't have, when they bring someone in, then they start waffling about how many resources they're willing to give someone. And then you have someone come into cardiology that becomes like a megalomaniacal emperor, and they have so many resources that no one else has anything. The cardiology is so strong. You know, it's very strong. Pulmonary is not strong. They just hired a young woman. I don't know how much strength she really brings to it. She's very young, from Harvard. Now, it may be her research that's brought her here. I hope she's a skillful physician. I have a feeling she's very bright. But still, it's a junior person. So, it makes me... It's unfortunate. It's been very nice that everybody has said how sorry they are. Everybody in terms of people in other departments and around the place have said they're sorry I'm going, but those are not important. My chairman said that the likelihood anything would happen for me here in the next 3 to 4 years is small. What he had in term, what he offered was that I would be promoted probably next year, maybe, if it went through the committees. But the likelihood I would be promoted because I had more in terms of my view than anybody else in the section. So the likelihood I'd be promoted is probably okay. But since I don't do wet bench stuff, though I am doing it now, and so that within the next year I will have a variety of laboratory with blood kinds of studies, you know, done. We're actively collecting this stuff right now. Honest to goodness, biomedical stuff. He wants to make sure I have a lot of stuff that would pass the biomedical academic committees. Well, I think that's not a problem. And I have my bibliography is, you know, CV's getting longer and longer and longer. Even despite all this, I keep publishing. What he said was that in the next 3 or 4 years, he had a plan by which he was going to phase out all the old VA people and therefore put in mainly newer people, therefore build ties to the VA, and therefore in 4 or 5 years, it's very likely that we would have a bridge if they didn't bring in anybody from the outside. And he really didn't think they were going to bring in anybody from the outside unless there was suddenly a new pot of money to bring someone in. And until we had a new dean, he really didn't see the priorities changing. So therefore, he thought it was really in my own best interest to take the position, because I'm going as an associate professor with tenure, and plus all these, you know, opportunities for program building. And he's right. Mm.
So it's really the dean at all points.
Well, he says so, but I think it's more than that. I think it's him, too. I don't think it's just the dean. I think it's him and his unwillingness to put strength behind programs that he really could if he wanted to. He could push the people at the VA and say, this is the way it has to be, because I need this in my department. But he's not willing to take them on. He just doesn't want to bother. Or he thinks that there's some links into the university hierarchy that give one of the people at the VA more power than they really have. The wife of the titular head of the geriatric program at the VA is an assistant dean to Cronin. But she really doesn't have much power. Her major responsibility is TA.
Who's that?
Judy Craig. Yeah, she's not that powerful figure.
She's fairly...
Well, he thinks that he doesn't want to do anything that disturbs her husband and the VA. And if her husband doesn't think that I should really run the program at the VA, then he doesn't want to do anything that might upset. Yeah, and I think that's lunacy, absolute sheer lunacy.
Well, I would think Judy would champion.
No, she. I don't know how well you know her. Do you know her?
I know just professionally.
Oh, Howard thinks that she's terrible. He thinks she's absolutely irresponsible and doesn't know what she's doing.
My goodness.
He really thinks that she causes more trouble than she really provides help in terms of facilitating departmental functioning. He's absolutely appalled at her. And as chairman, he's just really shocked at some of the stupid things she does. He doesn't think that she functions well at all. He thought that before he went over there in terms of just being head of a social area group and things of that sort. And he's completely convinced of it now after being a chairman. So. The chairman of medicine is relatively new here, and I think he's a little naive about how the university works, as are most of the people in medicine. They really don't respect the academic campus as much as they should.
Mm.
There's a pomposity about... ...university works. As are most of the people in medicine, they really don't respect the academic campus as much as they should.
Mm.
There's a pomposity about people in medicine with respect to the academic disciplines. They really think that they know more and better, and of course that's not true. No, that's not true. There are some that are very good, just as there are some who are really very good on the academic campuses, and this pomposity is unfortunate. But it's part of what I see in my profession. And I find it some of the least attractive, one of the least attractive attributes of many of my colleagues.
Well, very much for doing this in the fascinating. What do you have to say about Rutgers a year from now?
I'll be glad to give you a follow-up.
All right.